People of the world, we have an announcement. We have a new name.
What?
Drum roll, please, Katie.
Oh, okay.
Welcome to the Renew Europe podcast.
No, it is not. This is not a thing, Dominic. We haven't talked about it and it's not happening.
Sorry, that was a very nerdy joke of mine. The reason why I say that is because Emmanuel Macron and the Liberal group of the European Parliament were considering renaming themselves the Europeans. And we were very afraid of that and what it would do to our Google rating. And Katie even sent some tweets that threatened potential legal ramifications. But in the end, they went with a pretty bad name, I think, Renew Europe.
Awful name.
But the reason why I said we should rename it is because Katie was so like ready for a fight with Macron, and she was really up for having a legal dispute that would get us loads of publicity. So maybe we should just do it anyway and rename ourselves Renew Europe just for the sake of the fight, Katie.
Maybe we should. I like to think it was definitely like my threats of legal action that made them go with the terrible name Renew Europe, which sounds like a toothpaste brand or something, over the Europeans, which is an obviously great name. So yeah, sucks to be you, Macron.
Sucks to be him indeed.
So Dominic, you're back in the safety of Amsterdam now. You're back from the wild.
I am, yes. I just got back after a very long journey from Terschelling, one of the Wadden Islands in the north of the Netherlands that I think lots of people that don't live in the Netherlands don't even know exist. But it was really nice. There's this big theatre festival that I performed on last year, and my husband was working on it this year, and he had a really nice premiere yesterday, despite the fact that it was nearly thwarted by the fact that there was an endangered bird, Brauner Kikidief, which is some kind of harrier.
What a lovely name.
It is nice, isn't it? But it was really annoying because it was nesting in the middle of his the site. So it was a bit of a nightmare, and it was quite an ironic thing that nature was getting in the way of this performance, which is all about kind of a post-human, post-nature solar system.
Does your husband now hate nature because this little bird like ruined his performance and made him move everything around?
He does a little bit, although he found a way to, it kind of fits in with the production, basically.
Nice save. So what are we talking about on the podcast this week?
This week, we are going to be talking to the Bosnian journalist Alexander Breza, who wrote a really beautiful comment piece in The Guardian that we both really were touched by. It looks at his family's experience in Bosnia during the 1992 to 1995 war, and it also paints a picture of the difficulties in Bosnia today. The article made us realise that we, like much of the rest of Europe, have been ignoring or not realising the difficulties facing this very complicated country. And we thought it was about time that we changed that. So that's coming up later in the show.
But first, I think there's been quite a big anniversary this week, hasn't there?
Yes, there has. Last Wednesday would have been the 90th birthday of the teenage diarist Anne Frank, who died during the Second World War. There were various different commemorations for Anne across the world. There was a new selection of letters from her father, Otto, that was published. Google collaborated with the Anne Frank Foundation to give Street View access inside Anne's old house in Amsterdam, which is kind of beautiful and maybe a little bit creepy. But if you want to remember Anne this week, then I really recommend this beautiful article from Rachel Kadish on Slate.com. It's about Kadish's friendship with a childhood friend of Anne's, which might sound like a really convoluted connection to Anne Frank, but it makes sense when you read it, and it's really beautiful. It's called On the Search for Victims Who Are Too Perfect to Be Us, and we'll post a link on our show notes. Before we get to Good Week, Bad Week, I've got one more thing, Katie.
One more thing? Go on then.
I wanted to briefly talk about the Frauenstreik, or women's strike, that took place across Switzerland last Friday.
Oh yeah, the Grève des Femmes, as they're calling it in French-speaking Switzerland.
Women took to the streets in protest against the country's slow progress towards equality. Thousands of women didn't go to work for the day, and others opted to leave work at 3:30, making their day 20% shorter than normal, in order to highlight the 20% pay gap between men and women. Whilst things have clearly got better than they were 28 years ago, when there was this famous protest of around 500,000 people, many people think the progress is still too slow. 28 years ago, there were actually no women in government, and there was also no maternity leave in law. So things have improved. There are women in government, and there is a maternity law, but things still aren't great. One of our listeners, Vera Hiltbrunner, was marching in Bern and left us a voice memo about her experience.
Hi, this is Vera from Switzerland. Last Friday, I was participating at the nationwide Frauenstreik in Bern, my hometown, actually. And it was a very special event for me, actually, because it felt very empowering to be a part of this group of powerful, loud women who are supporting each other in this important matter and who are standing and sticking together to demand equal rights for everyone, actually, and dancing and singing and shouting through the streets of Bern felt very, very powerful. Bring the change, Switzerland.
Thank you so much, Vera. It was so nice to hear from you and to hear that it was such a positive experience marching in Switzerland. And in general, if people are on the ground at interesting things that are going on in Europe, send us voice memos. We love hearing from you. Good Week, Bad Week this week is on a kind of similar theme, and that theme is women's bodies and what we're allowed to do with them. Shall I start with Good Week?
Yeah, go for it.
So it's been a good week for French women. The government has announced that it's planning on lifting the current ban on lesbian couples and single women from having access to IVF and artificial insemination and basically all medically assisted forms of baby making. It's an idea that's been kicking around for a while now in France. And frankly, I think quite a lot of people in some other European countries would be quite shocked to hear that lesbian couples can't have IVF in France, which is supposedly a fairly open and forward-looking country. Actually, until now, you've had to be a straight couple, one man, one woman, living together for 2 years if you want access to IVF or sperm donors or anything like that. Which is kind of weird because gay civil partnerships have been legal in France since 1999 and we've had gay marriage here since 2013. So it's kind of inconsistent messaging from the state in terms of how accepted they want being gay to be in general. I mean, surely if you're going to let two women get married, you should also let them have access to everything that they need to start a family. So yeah, this issue has been pointed out for a long time by French feminist and gay rights groups that the law discriminates against people that want to start a family but don't fall into this very traditional mold of what the state expects a family to be. And it's an idea that the Macron government has been vaguely talking about changing since he took office 2 years ago. But now there's actually a solid timeline for the law getting changed, which is cool. So the Prime Minister, Edouard Philippe, this week he gave his State of the Nation speech, and he said that the legislation is going to start passing through Parliament in September. Now, there's quite a way ahead yet in terms of getting this law actually passed, because I don't know if you remember this, but back in 2012, 2013, when France was debating bringing in gay marriage, there were massive protests organised by Catholic and conservative groups in France. And that is part of why the Macron government has been delaying getting lesbian couples access to IVF, because there's been concerns that it would spark more massive protests. And as everyone knows, France has had quite a few massive street protests to deal with lately.
Mm-hmm.
So they were a bit like, maybe not the right time. But now that the whole Gilets Jaunes movement has died down a lot, the government has signaled that it is probably time to start looking at changing this. It is pretty outrageous as a state of affairs. So until now, French lesbian couples have had to go abroad to other countries if they want to use a sperm donor or get IVF.
Which countries have the best rules around IVF treatment in Europe, in your opinion?
So there's definitely like multiple countries that don't have this problem for lesbian couples. So if you live in Belgium and you're gay and you want to have a kid, for example, that shouldn't be a problem in terms of getting IVF. Sweden, Finland, Spain, the United Kingdom, despite its other problems, is kind of all right for this kind of thing. And until now, French women have been traveling abroad to get this kind of treatment.
Presumably that's an expensive way of doing it, though.
It is expensive, yeah. So yeah, it's not great. I was kind of surprised when I moved here and I realized just how paternalist the kind of administrative and like government structures are when it comes to family matters. So like the tax system gives really heavy incentives if you have lots of kids and stuff. Like when you get married, for example, my friends got married recently and they got given this little book where you can write details of all the up to eight children that you're going to have in this marriage, which is nice.
Wow. Lucky you.
I mean, it's nice to dream about these things. But yeah, so there's this very deep conservative streak when it comes as well to Catholic protest groups coming out against what they see as threats to the traditional family. And I do worry that that movement might rear its head again when Parliament starts debating this in September. But we will see.
Well, as you said earlier, we're sticking with women's reproductive systems for Bad Week as well, and moving to Germany, where it's been a bad week for Bettina Gaber and Verena Weyer, two doctors in Berlin who were fined €2,000 for describing a medical procedure in an advertisement. Now, the procedure they were describing was the termination of pregnancies, abortions. A law was passed in January actually allowing advertisements for abortions for the first time since a Nazi-era law was passed in 1933 banning the advertisement of abortions. So they are legally allowed to advertise abortions, but the court ruled that they are not allowed to describe the procedure, which seems a bit strange. The two female doctors were taken to court after some anti-abortion campaigners referred their advert to prosecutors. And here's the bit that really bugged me. The phrases the doctors used in their advert were not exactly over the top. They mentioned that they offer, quote, medicinal anesthesia-free, unquote, abortions. And they talked about a, quote, protected environment.
Okay, so it's not exactly like it's like, come and get an abortion here, it's going to be amazing. It's just literally explaining what it is.
Yeah, exactly. They weren't claiming it was going to be the easiest abortion in the world that wouldn't hurt you physically or emotionally. I'd say that was a pretty straightforward description. That said, I do feel a bit funny about advertising abortions. What do you think about that?
I think personally that women should have the right to all the information that they can have about stuff that's potentially going to happen to their bodies. I think the more information the better, no?
I totally agree, but call me old-fashioned, but I'm just against the kind of commercialization and marketization of healthcare generally. So the fact that providers need to compete and advertise at all makes me feel quite icky.
But then you were coming at that from like a sort of British perspective where we have like a full national health service where there are like not that many private elements to it.
We did 15 years ago, yeah.
Oh, how times have changed. But do you know what I mean? In terms of just like different like setups in terms of how insurance works or whatever.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe I'm coming at it from a utopian background. And I agree that I don't think it should be something that's made more taboo than any other procedures. I mean, obviously, it is something that is going to be more sensitive than some other procedures. But the thing I find so ridiculous about this is that they are allowed to advertise their services. They're just not allowed to describe the services. It does seem very silly. But it also got me thinking about the fact that abortion has been in the news a lot lately, mainly because of the shocking laws that are going through various American state legislative bodies, with some suggestion that anti-abortion campaigners are hoping that one of these draconian laws will make it to the Supreme Court and Roe versus Wade will be knocked down, this famous law that protects the woman's right to privacy when deciding whether to have an abortion. Here in Europe, these depressing stories from America have been covered in our national presses, but we mustn't fall into the trap of ignoring what is happening closer to home. Abortion rights is not just an American issue. Look at Malta, the smallest EU state. They have a total ban on abortion. A woman and her doctor can be put in jail for having an abortion, even in cases of rape. Many people aren't aware that in part of the United Kingdom, in Northern Ireland, abortion is also banned. At least in Northern Ireland, there is an exception in the law if the woman's life is in danger. In Malta, that exception is there in practice, but not actually stated in the law. The abortion laws, of course, vary widely across the EU, and in most countries, it is legal. But it's issues like this that made us want to start this podcast in the first place. I knew more about American abortion laws than European abortion laws. If you would like to look more into the different laws across the EU, then I will post an article from France 24 in the show notes that has a really good summary. And now, should we talk about something that isn't women's reproductive systems?
Let's. We're going to go to the southeastern corner of Europe, to Bosnia. You might have seen, if you're a Twitter user, this article in The Guardian published last week, this article of Alexander's. It was tweeted quite heavily. It's a very powerful article. He basically says in it, look, my country went through this horrific war in the 90s, and thankfully that is behind us now. But things are really bad now in Bosnia for various reasons. Nationalism is rising, and some people are talking about trying to break the country apart, and loads of people are leaving looking for work. And because of this very sort of delicate government structure that was set up after the war, things work in a sort of quite haphazard fashion in Bosnia. And we don't talk about any of this stuff enough, frankly, in the rest of Europe. So that is why we want to talk about it today on The Europeans. So we gave Alexander a call. You talk about various different problems that Bosnia is facing in this very powerful article that you wrote for The Guardian, including like really messy political structures in the country and rising nationalism and people leaving the country in huge numbers. Do you see those problems as sort of interconnected? I just wonder if we can map them out a little bit.
I think they are interconnected. I think they're a result of 25 years of this post-Dayton, post-peace agreement years in Bosnia and all of the decisions that have been made in the run-up to today, to 2019. We are in a situation where the system that was set up by the Dayton Peace Accord has allowed certain ethno-national politicians to block the functioning of it. So that in practice means that you have a government that hasn't been formed since the elections, which took place in October 2018. I think it's kind of obvious that what's going on and that what's at play is two major separatist groups, the Bosnian Serb leadership and the current Bosnian Croat leadership, are doing their best to prove that it's a dysfunctional country in order to make another appeal or an attempt at its dissolution.
And so the political system in Bosnia is like one of the most complicated political systems in the world, isn't it? Each ethnic group is represented kind of separately, and there are three different presidents, is that right?
How should I say this? Yes, it is complex, but it can actually work, and it has worked until now. And with a couple of modifications, it would probably be quite functional otherwise. The country itself is divided between two entities, like I said, and one district. And then one of the entities, the Federation of Bosnia, has 10 cantons. So in total, we have how many levels of government? 14, right? And yeah, like you said, on top of that, there's the tripartite presidency, which itself, I mean, its organization has been contested because someone like me, for instance, someone who identifies not as a Bosniak, being a Bosnian Muslim or a Bosnian Serb or a Bosnian Croat, but just as a Bosnian, cannot be a member of the presidency. So you're actually talking to someone who cannot be a president of his country, which should be illegal, right?
Wow, I didn't realize that was possible.
Yeah, that's absolutely possible. And not only is it possible, but there were numerous cases which kind of ruled that this needs to be fixed. And it's been how many years? I think at this point it's been 14 years, but nobody's done anything about it.
How unusual are you in that extent, in the fact that you identify as a Bosnian? Is there like a movement towards more maybe younger people identifying in that way?
That's a really good question. According to our census, there's around 3 to 4% of people who identify as Bosnians, which sounds like a rather small number, but it's a consequence of the system. Because if you don't identify, you don't qualify for a number of positions. I worked at an organization, which is basically our national public broadcaster, where you're not explicitly asked, but you know that if you want to be hired for a high-level position, for instance, editor-in-chief of the newsroom or head of the radio department, you need to be one of the three. You need to belong to one of the three ethnic groups. So many people have, for practical matters, decided to be either Bosniak, Serb, or Croat.
So you think something needs to be done. What do you think Europe could do to help?
Our electoral law has to be fixed to make sure that everyone has equal opportunity to get elected. One other way is to, which is probably the most important at this point, is to deal with corruption. Corruption is something that's ever present. It's a daily issue. If somebody was to come in and insist on these things getting resolved, I think it would actually help the country a lot.
The European Union have been dangling membership in front of Bosnia for a while. I was wondering to what extent that is helping corruption dissipate, or is it really not very likely at the moment, so people have kind of forgotten about it?
I think people still have a positive opinion of our possibility of joining the European Union. It's just that people have become disillusioned by 2019 because we're still not even a candidate country. We're the only country practically aside from Kosovo, which doesn't have candidacy status. I know that corruption has to be dealt with before we could potentially enter the EU. But I don't see that kind of being the line of thinking of anybody in the country being like, okay, we want to enter into the EU, check. We need to deal with corruption. And in general, I think joining the EU, it just seems so far away. There's no clear interest in the member states for Bosnia to enter anytime soon, or many of the Western Balkan countries. And I think that's a pretty major issue, because if you're leaving out these six countries, they're smack down in the middle of Europe. What are you actually saying? That Europe is not, that the European Union is not a place for all Europeans, that we can enter the EU but one person at a time? And this is something that, you know, has been kind of happening. Hundreds of thousands of people have left Bosnia over the course of the last several early years. And the joke that I just referenced, how are Bosnians going to enter the EU one Bosnian at a time, is becoming true.
What kind of effects has that been having within the country on the ground?
On a micro scale, people are noticing that there's, you know, less people doing certain jobs. So it's extremely difficult to find a plumber. It's very difficult to find an electrician. It's very difficult to find someone who will replace your roof shingles now. On a much larger scale, it is extremely detrimental to our pension system, for instance, or a healthcare system, because all of those workers, they're not paying taxes in Bosnia. They're not adding to these budgets. So eventually what we're going to have, and we already have it, but it's going to get worse, is you're going to have a crisis where the government itself is not going to have enough funds to, you know, pay out the pensions of the of people who have already retired, or fund the healthcare of the people who live in the country.
When we zoom out and take a look at the sort of wider Balkan neighbourhood, you talk more broadly about a couple of other worrying phenomena like Serbia building up its military. Does it feel in general like the picture for the region is very scary right now?
Well, it depends. You know, you have countries like Montenegro who are obviously small and are on the right track. They have already joined NATO. And when you examine the political scene in Serbia, you will notice that there's almost no one on the, to the left. The party in power is sort of center-right, but even their main opposition is further right. So it feels like there is no civic response to these kind of populist ideas that the people in power, Aleksandar Vučić and people around him, have. And at the same time, you have Croatia, who's already in the EU, and there you have this kind of unfair power balance, where Croatia is already in the EU and kind of got into the EU much sooner than everyone else. And now, as a full-fledged EU member state, has this sense that it can dictate certain things to the rest of the region.
Talking of Croatia, there's been this really odd case in Croatia that I wondered if you could explain a bit. People within the Croatian intelligence services have been accused of planting weapons in mosques in Bosnia in order to frame the country as being a hotbed of Islamic terrorism.
Right.
What's going on there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. What's going on? Okay, first of all, let's say that this is still alleged and it hasn't been proven to be absolutely true. So let's take it with a grain of salt. But I wish I was there at that meeting when somebody came up with the city and was like, listen, we've been telling everyone in Europe how Bosnia is full of radical terrorists. We need to do something about it. And then someone says, I have a brilliant idea. Let's go find some radical Muslims and give them bombs and weapons and stuff. And then we can point our fingers at them and be like, look, look, we were right. And everyone agrees, because this is basically what happened. First of all, let me dismantle this whole idea about radical terrorists in Bosnia, that there's no such thing. You have Salafis, which are conservative Muslims, and this very conservative interpretation of Islam. I think that was initially enough for some people to get a little bit worried about what's going on, but while at the same time our Ministry of Security and the then minister, who actually, you know, was working on these cases of people who did volunteer and go to Syria and who have fought there, was constantly debunking and saying, no, we know the number of people who have left. At the same time, there's no one in Bosnia who's, you know, participating in any kind of terrorist stuff, right? And I guess just saying it wasn't enough. So, like we said, there was this idea by the Croatian intelligence agency to find those who are close to the radical circles and then find a way to compromise them into basically taking a cache of weapons, putting it in a mosque or a masjid, so that Croatia can say, look, they are terrorists. And of course, they're fully denying it. At the same time, there was another scandal in Slovenia, luckily for everyone, where it also, you know, Croatian intelligence was spying on its Slovenian counterparts regarding their own issues. And that kind of brought more, you know, attention to the actual issue in Bosnia.
This is what the kids would call shady AF. That's like, that's mad.
That's a good way of putting it. I think it is shady AF, yes.
In your article, you talked about your 8th birthday party in Sarajevo in 1992 and how normal it felt and the slightly surreal sense that nothing terrible could happen. Things are very, very different now, of course, but I just wondered if there is this kind of familiar sense of things getting dangerous, but people having this sort of general sense of denial about it.
Yeah, you can definitely see that some people are like, no, you know, nothing's going to happen. You're being an alarmist. But I think it's a much smaller number than before, which is also quite indicative. You know, in 92, I think it was the majority of people who were thinking this cannot happen to us. And now I think it's a rather small minority of those who are absolute optimists. There's this basic human quality of people just wanting to have a normal life, you know? So all of this talk, be it my article or be it whoever else, of a potential conflict in the future, gets them upset because, look, all I want to do is go to work, come home, play with my kid, kiss my wife, that kind of thing. And when someone else is talking about war, it just stirs up all of these negative memories, re-traumatizes people, etc. Let's not forget that a large number of people still have PTSD and are dealing with PTSD, I think.
Yeah.
Somewhere between, what is it, 1/8 and 1/2 of the population, which is a lot. So am I seeing people still thinking that nothing can happen? Yeah. You know, on a good day, I think nothing can happen. But when you look at the larger picture and when you look at how horrible the politics themselves are and how horrible the people in power themselves are, you see that it's a very thin line that we're walking at the moment.
Alexander has his own podcast. It's about Southeastern Europe. It's called Sarajevo Calling, and it's a really good listen, especially if you want to hear more about politics in the Western Balkans. So give it a listen.
You should also follow him on Twitter for good tweetings about what's happening in Bosnia and the Balkans. We will post a link to that in our show notes too.
It's been a bit of a heavy week this week, so maybe a happy ending is necessary.
Cheer me up, please.
Okay. Well, I've got a happy ending for you this week that really is a Hollywood happy ending. That is, despite the fact that the story's starting point is the D-Day landings, which is pretty gauche for me to suggest that that event that led to so many deaths could have a happy ending. But putting that aside, it's the story of Cara Troy, a strapping American soldier who arrived in France, aged 24, in 1944 as part of the D-Day landings. Whilst in France, he fell in love with a local 18-year-old woman, Janine Pearson, and they fell madly in love despite not speaking the same language. One morning, Cara was called away suddenly and had to move onto the Eastern Front. After the war, he went back to America and married someone else, but he kept hold of a photo of Janine and they both kept each other in their hearts, even though they didn't have any contact. Cara came back to France for the D-Day commemorations, and whilst he was there, he showed his photo of this girlfriend to some French journalists who got to work tracking Janine down. Was it you, Katie?
It was me. No, I would love to be responsible for this amazing piece of matchmaking, but no, Zaddy, it wasn't me.
Well, yeah, as Katie just gave away, they found her and they organized a very emotional reunion for these two lovers who had last seen each other almost 75 years ago. They only enjoyed a few hours together, and whilst Janine had learnt a few English phrases in the hope that he would return, they still have quite a significant language barrier, and therefore I personally don't think it's a goer, even though they're both widowed.
God, this is a happy ending.
That said, Janine did understand what he said when he said that he had always loved her. And when they said goodbye, Cara whispered, "Janine, I love you, girl." And they promise to see each other again. Don't know where, don't know when, though.
I find the idea of like love that crosses a language barrier quite fascinating. I've got a friend who is a teacher here in France, and she says some of her kids, the kids are the translators for the parents because the parents don't speak each other's language. And I find that amazing. And I do sometimes wonder if certain partners that I know in my life might get on better if they didn't speak the same language.
Ooh, dark.
Fun thing to test out. But what a lovely story, though.
It's beautiful.
Well, I have to go and sit in the sun now with my neighbours because it's a beautiful evening in Paris and that is the law.
Oh, you poor thing.
I know, it's terrible. So that is all we have time for this week. But until we're back next week, as always, you can find us on the internet in many different places. We are on Twitter at EuropeansPod. We are on Instagram at EuropeansPodcast. And you can find us on Facebook. Just type in the Europeans Podcast.
Big thanks again to all our Patreon supporters. You could too be one of them if you went to patreon.com/EuropeansPodcast. Thank you to Giuseppe Moretti and Fraser Seifert this week for becoming new supporters. Yay. We are really grateful. It's a really feeble yay.
Yay.
Anyway, Katie, go sit out in the evening sun and don't drink too much.
And you go and rest your weary legs after all your cycling.
Oh, I will. Jeepers creepers.
It's lying down time. See you next week, everyone.
Adios, amigos.
Stravo.